This is Ask with your host, Michelle Martin, on 938 Live.
Welcome to Ask. I'm Michelle Martin. It is such a privilege to have with us here in the studio Andrew Grant. He is a co-author of Who Killed Creativity? A brilliant, brilliant book. You must pick this up if you're at all interested in how you can up your CQ. He wrote it along with Gaia Grant, his wife, and Dr. Jason Galati. And we're going to find out more about these essential strategies. Andrew says that there are 7 that you can use to make yourself, your team, and your organization more innovative. So first up, welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thanks very much.
I heard you speak this morning. You gave the plenary session at Creating the Future, Innovation and the Global Challenge that was organized by SMU's We Kim Wee Center. And it was brilliant. I thought you gave a fantastic presentation. Tell us first why you wanted to take the CSI approach to creativity. Creativity is personified as a victim, a murder victim. So tell us a little bit about the framework.
Well, very simple. We didn't want to write a creative book and not be creative in writing it.
Oh, yeah, that would be awful.
I mean, I remember my first lecture at university in education got up there and bored me with a lecture. You know, when you're teaching on education, you want to present it educationally. If I'm going to write a book on creative thinking and innovation, heaven help it if we just write another 7 ways to do it without putting some sort of theme. Mm-hmm. But also from an educational background, we want people to remember it. You know, we sit through so many talks, we read so many books. The question is, how many do we actually remember? I think the statistics are 4 out of 5 managers fail to read or finish the books they start, let alone if they remember them. So we wanted to write a book with impact. I know we've made it a bit gory and we've made it a bit, gruesome, but people are going to remember it.
It is very memorable.
And if you start, of course we say all the characters are fictional. We don't want anyone pointing names at anyone, but we want people to remember it and we want people to think about it and apply it and get it away from just being this dry academic book.
It's almost a book you experience because these are characters and you can sort of identify with some or, you give them personalities almost. And that, do you believe experiential learning is important?
I think that's the only way people remember. I mean, it was fun. We co-wrote it with a psychologist and neuroscientist with a PhD in the topic. We wanted to make sure that we weren't just giving these names for a bit of fluffy reason or a bit of PR. We wanted to actually make sure that there's some serious psychology behind it. So not only have we given these characters names that of what we've identified we think blocks creativity, and the second half of the book is how to bring it back, so we don't want to get too negative. But we wanted to put personality disorders behind them to see if there is a real connection between some of them. And that's become an interesting discovery in itself as well.
I'm glad you bring that up because personality disorder is definitely something that we want to talk about when we address creativity at the workplace. I think most people, we hear them say, oh, my boss is awful. I have a terrible boss. But they don't realize that sometimes, literally, the boss could have a lot in common with a psychopath.
Well, I'm not the psychologist out of the 3 of us, so I'm going to be careful and I don't want people ringing in describing their boss just in case he's listening as well. But the research shows that at any one time, 30% of the population is suffering from some personality disorder. Look, it's not a black and white. It's a very grey thing. I think we're all a bit strange. And look, at the back of the book, we want to say that creativity doesn't get off scot-free either. There's a bit of a twist in the back of the book. Creativity also comes with its own challenges.
And a lot of creative people are eccentric.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, look, really none of us are normal. I think if you're normal, you're boring. what we want to look at is are there environmental factors in the workplace and at home that are stopping us being creative? And when I say creative, I mean creative thinking. I don't mean artistic.
Yes.
I mean looking for solutions, looking for faster solutions, better solutions, more efficient solutions. Heaven help it, if I walked into one of my banking clients and said we're going to be artistic today, they'd run for the back door. But if I walked into one of my banking clients and said we're going to improve processes, we're going to make your job faster, more efficient, more effective, you're going to reach a larger group, they all want to listen.
Now, during your plenary session today, you wowed the audience when you carried out 2 magic tricks. And I like how you really use magic as an analogy to explain this phrase that people associate with creativity all the time, which is thinking out of the box. Now, can you tell us about these boxes which limit creativity?
Well, look, unfortunately, we're so familiar with the concept of thinking outside the box, I hesitate to bring it up. And yet, I think to me, it's the ultimate definition of creative thinking. So what I like to do, and I'm not a magician, but it's fun to try it. And
fooled me.
I fooled a few people sitting up the back. and they're up on the website if people want to look at the magic tricks in detail. So if you really want to know, go and have a look. But I think this is the funny thing. I'm not a magician, but I can fool people. But I wouldn't use the word fool. The analogy I use is that what a magician does is a magician gets people by distraction, by disillusionment, maybe by deception, to focus in a particular area. The classic one is a coin swap with a great sleight of hands. They get you focusing on the left hand while they do something with their right hand. And the analogy we're using there is that just as a magician gets its audience to focus inside a box while he works outside the box, we believe that people, through conditioning, through media, through their environment, through school, through whatever, often are looking for solutions in a very defined place. And what we're trying to get creative people to do, or to be creative in their thinking or innovative, or the innovative companies of this world say, well, great, that's one place to look for solutions. But maybe there are many, many different other places. And I know we'll get onto school in a minute, but often the problem with school is it encourages people to only look for one solution. So we tick a box, we move on to the next question.
Biggest barriers to creativity, the idea that there can be only one right answer.
That's right. And that's what school told us for 12 years. Absolutely. So we get to work, and just like the magician, we solve a solution in a box. And we don't stop and say, maybe there's another way to look at it. Can we find a different way to look at it? And so this is why I think the magic trick is such a powerful analogy. I mentioned Darren Brown can on camera pickpocket someone after he's telling them he's going to pickpocket them, because he uses distraction to make them focus in a particular area.
And in fact, on the cover of your book, you know, you illustrate this whole way of how the magician really stages, or rather influences, very interestingly. You have a series of questions, and I'm going to read it out to the listener. You say, what are the chances of finding an elephant in your backyard? Never, sometimes, often, always. So take a moment, think about it, and answer that. What are the chances of finding an elephant in your backyard? Chances are you're going to say never. And then you ask, what are the chances of finding creativity in your workplace?
Well, if you look to the back of the book, which is, I'm just madly trying to find the back of the book. The questions are there again. What are the chances of finding an elephant in your backyard? Now, a friend of ours' daughter, when she was age 7, she said always. And the teacher said, no, you're wrong. And she replied back, Miss, if there was an elephant in my backyard, of course I would find it. So again, we tend to get focused into one particular area. What are the chances of finding creativity? If it's there, we'll find it. But we have to be looking. And again, out of the mouths of babies come some of the most profound things. And we've done a lot of work in schools and a lot of work with kids, and we've mapped it to corporate work. And we've also mapped it to research from Harvard and some of the big universities. Mm-hmm. We find what the kids say, you know, white papers are written on. And yet the kids say it so simply. And that brings us to the issue of what's happened. And that's why we came up with this crime scene. You know, we seem to start off creative. We enter kindergarten. You saw the video this morning. It's up on YouTube. It's called Hands Up. We went into a school in Indonesia, an international school. We asked every grade who thinks they're creative. Mm. The kindergarten kids were falling over the back of themselves trying to put their hands up saying they're creative. Mm. And as we went from kindergarten to grade 1 to grade 2 all the way through to grade 12, the graph went steadily down until grade 12, one brave boy put his hands up.
That is so sad.
So this to us is, there is a crime scene out there. We all remember as ourselves or with kids. We remember entering into school creative, and somewhere during that 12-year process, I know it happened to my daughter in grade 5, I said to the teacher, what happened? What went wrong? My daughter finally came home and said, that's it, I hate school. The enthusiasm had worn off. And I said to the teacher, what happened? She said, we're preparing them for high school. Then some of us go on to uni, but then we hit the corporate world. So there is a crime scene out there. We believe that creativity has been killed. Now, you saw today I asked the participants in the room. These are participants that came on a creative conference. They weren't pushed into it by their boss. How many of them felt they were creative in kindergarten? 90% put their hands up. I asked again, how many think they are less creative now? They all put their hands up. I get, well, so about 90%. So 90% of people believe, and this happens to over and over all around the world when we've conducted these surveys, believe that they are more creative in kindergarten than they are now.
What is it about the school system that seems to drum out creativity? Hold the thought. Andrew will come back and chat with Andrew Grant. And your questions are already coming through at 669-11938 in just a while. Stay with us.
This is Ask with your host, Michelle Martin, on 938 Live.
And my guest is Andrew Grant, co-author of a brilliant book on creativity called Who Killed Creativity and How Can We Get It Back? 7 Essential Strategies to Make Yourself, Your Team, and Your Organization More Innovative. Andrew, you lived and worked in Asia for the last 15 years, and so the book is peppered with examples from Asia. And you mentioned there is a quote there about Singapore's education system and how it churns out people managers.
Well, I want to be very careful here. I don't want to say what was said, but I do remember seeing a quote from a Singapore education minister many, many years ago in Time magazine that said, we're breeding predictable people for reliable times. And I think he went on to say that was good in the past, that worked in the past, but now I think Singapore is realizing that what worked in the past may not necessarily work in the future. Mm. And to keep up with the rapid pace of change, their predictable managers for reliable times may not be what employees are looking for now. We're looking for the creativity people that are able to bring their companies into what's going to happen next. Riding that wave of disruptive innovation, knowing it's coming and being prepared for it rather than sitting back and letting the change happen all around us.
So do you think most school systems, the flaw is that somewhere along the way they've lost sight that they're supposed to be imparting skills that allow people to keep learning across a lifetime?
Well, I think what's happening is you get rewarded for what's measured. So school measures correct answers. It doesn't measure creative answers. You get rewarded for being correct. You don't get rewarded for being creative. As a matter of fact, if you're rewarded for being creative, you're almost kicked out. Now, I'm not saying to replace one with the other, but I think we need to maybe, you know, get rid of the multiple choice to a degree and say, okay, well, that's one right answer. Is there another one? Can you think of a better one? Can you think of a faster one? Otherwise, we come to the workplace and there's that predictable managers for reliable times.
Well, there
we
you come have to the KPIs and, again,
that's
right?
That's right. We get one answer. It's good enough.
Mm.
Now, you know, things are moving so fast these days, good enough isn't going to work. We have to keep going back looking for the best.
Mm-hmm. Why is creativity no longer, a luxury?
Well, this is interesting. When we first started teaching this in 15 years ago, many conferences were coming into Bali, where we lived, and they would say, we've done our presentation skills, we've done our team building, you know, we've done negotiation. What else can we do? Let's do one on creative thinking. And so we would do it, and, you know, they'd see it as a luxury. I think what we're seeing happening now with the disruptive innovation and how fast things are moving and the pace of life is moving so fast, that creative thinking is no longer a luxury. It's affecting every single company. One of the challenges I ask, and it's a famous quote by Bill Gates, it says, banks are not necessary, banking is. Now, if Google got into your industry, I mean, Google is eating up industries left, right, and center, what would you do? And so we need to think about how companies are just moving. There are companies that are less than 10 years old that are threatening companies that are 110 years old. Mm-hmm. Take the publishing industry, for example.
And Amazon, which is an example.
The publishing companies are scared stiff of Amazon. They don't know what to do.
Mm.
Amazon created
and do you have
a,
the answer, the creative
sorry?
Answer?
Well,
I'm a book reviewer, I have to ask.
Not in 30 seconds, but we have to look at what is it that people want. One of the interesting quotes from the Amazon CEO was when he was the first person that allowed people to put negative reviews up on the website. And he got a lot of flack from putting up the negative reviews. And he said, we don't help customers buy books. We're here to help customers make great decisions.
Mm.
So he was giving the customer what he wants. Often, we don't give the customer what they want. We give the customer what we think they want.
Mm-hmm.
What Amazon did, if we looked at behind or under, and eBay, is they started to saying, well, we'll let the customer innovate. So there's another interesting thing. If we don't innovate, the customer's going to innovate. And you know how they innovate? They go somewhere else.
Mm.
So innovation is no longer a luxury. It's an absolute necessity.
I am so enjoying this conversation. And I know you are too. So call through with your questions at 669-11938. Sorry, couldn't put you through the first half of the discussion, but we will as soon as we can here on Ask with me, Michelle Martin, and my guest, Andrew Grant, the man behind the book, Who Killed Creativity? Stay tuned.
This is Ask with your host, Michelle Martin, on 938 Live.
And my guest is co-author of the book, Who Killed Creativity and How Can We Get It Back? 7 Essential Strategies to Make Yourself, Your Team, and Your Organization More Innovative. His name is Andrew Grant. Welcome, Andrew. And now I have to start with a little plug for my show, which is called Ask. And you write here that you believe that questions are a great way to learn, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad we're on the same page there.
As a matter of fact, we've talked a lot about Who Killed Creativity, but the first half of the book is Who Killed Creativity. The second half of the book, and it's equally divided, is How to Get It Back. Mm. The Who Killed's more gory, and we love the CSI shows. You know, we'd rather watch a CSI show than a positive show. But the very first chapter of the second half of the book is we have to start by asking questions. Mm. This is where, if we're talking about getting it back, it's cultivating curiosity. If we don't ask questions, won't be creative. So right. That's our first rescue strategy, because I often get in trouble for talking too much about the gory side of it.
But let's talk a little bit about things that shut creativity off. And we were talking during the break about how, you know, you experience an accident, a surfing accident, and that brought up an insight into how we can sometimes get into survival mode. Our brains.
That's correct.
I'll
keep this very simple. The neuroscience is all through the book, written with our neuroscientist Jason Gelati. But very, very simply, we have a primitive brain and a more modern brain. And the primitive brain is the one that deals with the fight or flight, the survival mentality. We've all experienced it to a degree, whether we've walked close towards a car or felt scared walking home at night. 2 years ago, I had a major surfing accident in Bali, a place that I surf very, very regularly. Tipped me upside down, pumped me head first into the reef, and I ended up with 88 stitches in my head and almost paralyzed. Ironically, when that happened, I had never thought more clearer in my life. Something happened, some chemicals kicked into my brain, and I went into absolute survival mode. I had to paddle in, I had to arrange for my kids to come in, I had to walk upstairs. Everyone that looked at me almost fainted. Got myself to hospital, argued over the insurance company with a hole in my head, and then finally got 88 stitches and 1.5 hour surgery. But I'd never thought more clearly in my life. And this was the primitive survival brain kicking in. Now, what we've realized in the research is, as much as we think it, and I know people are going to ring up and argue with me, you can't multitask. You can hyperthread, but you cannot multitask. This is the neuroscience. This is straight facts. Whilst we are working in the survival mode of our brain only has a certain amount of bandwidth. With the survival part, the primitive part of our brain is taking over, which it needed to keep me alive. The new section of the brain, the more modern section of the brain, which is where our creativity is working, can't exist. Now, that was an extreme situation, that surfing situation. Mm. But hey, you've got a boss telling you that he needs his numbers, he needs the numbers by 5 o'clock at night. This puts you into the survival mode. Most of us spend a lot of our time at work and at home in that survival mode. And as a result of that, we're not able to exercise creativity. So I'm not saying we leave the survival mode. There are plenty of times we need it. But if we want to be creative, if we want to be innovative, we need to create the environment for that more modern part of our brain to start kicking in, because we can only do one or the other.
Let's invite Adrian, a caller, to join us in this conversation. Hi, Adrian.
Hello.
Good evening. What's your question?
First question, creative question.
Mm.
Can I get a free book from you?
Oh, my. Did you hear that, Andrew? We had Adrian calling to say he wants a free book.
A free book?
Oh,
you'd have to talk to our publishers.
I'll see what I can do.
You'll have to talk to Michelle, but they are available on the website.
But do you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. If you discover you have a creative side in you, how do you nurture it? Apart from the environment that you mentioned about, how do you nurture it on your own, in a sense?
Oh, this is a good point, because I think, you know, when we've been talking for the last hour, we can talk on an individual level, we can talk on a team level, an organizational level, or last week I did an interview with Reuters and they asked me about China. And I said, well, I can't answer that one in 30 seconds. So thank you for being a little bit more specific and talking about the individual. I think, the first thing we need to understand is we need to be aware of, as I said, these are fictional characters, but we need to be aware of the 7 characters that we've identified in the book and when they're haunting us. For example, we might hear in a meeting someone saying, oh, we tried that last year, it didn't work. Well, that's apathy speaking, or narrow-mindedness speaking. We need to be aware of that and say, well, that's great, but, you know, if I want to be creative, I've just identified that killer's lurking around me. And then secondly, we need to know what are the ones that are most pressing on us, and then start to look at the rescue strategies. So, for example, the one on control, which is our first killer off the ranks, the control crew, that one is overcome by courage. and by asking questions. So if we want to overcome control, we have to learn to develop courage. If we want to overcome the pessimism posse, which is our last murder suspect, then, Martin Seligman's stuff on optimism. There's a whole book written on called Learned Optimism, which helps you retrain your brain. And we touch on it in our book, but it helps you retrain your brain to move away from a pessimistic mindset to an optimistic mindset. So
why
first
is
of all...
this important, really?
Well, which one?
The attitude, the climate.
Let's take the example of the pessimism posse, which is our last murder suspect, and then the rescuer, which is the optimism to come back in. Look, we all get knocked down. We all have failures, but the difference between a pessimistic mindset and an optimistic mindset is the pessimistic mindset talks to themselves and can't get back up again. The optimistic mindset, well, maybe there's another way, maybe this just happened today, but tomorrow will be different. Let's take dieting, for example. We blow a diet, we say, that's it, I'm never going dieting again because I always blow diets. That's the pessimistic mindset, taking a simple situation and making it universal. The optimism will say, well, I blew it today, but tomorrow's a new day.
Mm-hmm. And so it's almost the self-coach.
It's the self-talk. So while we talk on the topic of individuals, all of these characters, it's the self-talk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, pessimistic people struggle to be creative because they don't want to look for solutions. They don't want to look for solutions. Mm. Whereas optimistic people are always looking for different solutions. They'll get up and they'll bounce back and whatever happened yesterday, I'm going to start again today. So that's one example. But I think, first of all, we have to identify which are the killers that are lurking behind us that are stopping us personally. And they'll be different for everyone. And then once we've worked out, well, these are the ones that are most, gathering around us, let's move away from them and let's bring those rescuers back.
Adrian, does that answer your question?
Yes. Better if I read the book.
I think you should.
Why don't you go and buy the book? That would help a little bit.
Thanks very much, Adrian, for your question. We'll take more at 669-11938. If you would like to speak directly with Andrew Grant, author of the book Who Killed Creativity and How Can We Get It Back? Now, you have a wonderful tool that companies can use. It's called the Who Killed Creativity Game Pack, an action pack discovery exercise that people can play in teams. Tell us more about
this. Well, that's the long version. It's the CSI game.
A CSI game, all right.
So what we do is we have if someone said to you, what's the matter? You won't pour out your problems. A good facilitator, a good leader will bring those out. So we want to do a non-threatening game. You can download off whokillcreativity.com a PDF file with some PowerPoint slides and some cards, and you've got a game board in front of you that's got all the places around the office.
You don't have to pay for this game.
Oh, no, you do. It's a paid game. Just a little bit, though, not much.
Okay.
There's all these places that we've identified, from sales and marketing through to the coffee shop, through to the playground, the bathroom, the boss's office, accounts, and then you download the cards and then what the idea is, we get people to discussing where do they think the top ones are, so we play it like a Cluedo game. Who killed creativity? Where was it killed? And with what weapon? Again, that's the first half. Then when we've identified as a team, look, these are the things that are the most threatening us. Well, now we need to look at, well, if this is the thing that's most threatening us, what's going to bring it back? And it's interesting, as we've done this around the world, I mean, to be very anecdotal, Australians, the big one is apathy and pressure.
In Europe,
it's often bureaucracy.
And in Singapore, it's fear
of failure, fear of taking risks. So if this is the challenge that are holding people back in Singapore, then that's what we need to identify. That's what we need to address. Why do we struggle with the fear of taking risks? Why do we struggle with the fear of failure? And once we can identify what that is, then, like a good doctor, now we can start giving a prescription. Now we can start bringing in the rescuers. So the second half of the game is, okay, we've got everyone talking in a safe environment. No one's going to go up to their boss and say, I'm afraid of failure. Mm. You lose face. But if we play a fun game and we've got cards and we've got characters, that's so much easier to then talk in a safe environment where people are feeling. So we played it with one company where every single table, independently of each other, agreed it was the pessimism posse with a weapon of noxious negativity in the coffee shop.
Mm.
Now, when every single table independently agreed with that, that company's got an issue. If you compare that to Google, that actually pay people to go to the coffee shop and create a beautiful coffee shop because they know that this is where the non-conscious processing happens.
Well, this is the problem. I mean, there is a mindset. And have you sensed it in Asia that loafing is considered
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got that article in the Straits Times yesterday where we're shoving our children from one activity to another.
There's this focus of trying to look busy all the time, and if you're not
right. I mean, it starts at kids. We pick them up from school and we ship them to violin lessons and tennis lessons and swimming lessons, and there's no chance to play. We move into the corporate world. You want to be first to work, last out of work to impress your boss. It doesn't matter how productive we are. We just want to be seen to be doing work. We don't get that downtime. If we don't get the downtime, then another killer, stress, is constantly becomes our friend. And with stress breathing down our neck, or as I said, the primitive part of our brain in fight or flight mode, it's not possible to be creative.
Mm.
People can go for weeks at a time without being creative because they're constantly living in that fight or flight mode.
Mm. As opposed to Google, you were touching on, which has built a fabulous coffee shop for people to...
Well, that's right. A lot of the companies now are realizing that it's... again, in the book, our psychologist, our neuroscientist, talks about non-conscious process. You know, you ask anyone where they had a creative moment. It's not at work. It's in the shower. It's driving home right now. It's when your brain...
In the bathtub.
It's where your brain starts to unwind. It's sleeping on it.
Mm.
We have to create these opportunities in the workplace for people to have these creative ideas. And that's why the playground is such an important part. You know, we metaphorically call it the playground, but it could be the coffee shop. It could be just having a break. We challenge lawyers of one of the world's biggest companies to stop billing in 6-minute sections and after lunch have a break. And we gave the solid research behind it. The boss got up and said, that's it. We're going to have half an hour downtime.
I just spoke with an organizational anthropologist who said one of the key circles of influence was the smoking circles. That's where people got locked
by because, you see, I mean, the smoking room could be another. I mean, I don't smoke.
I mean, we're not advocating smoking.
Not
we're
at
just
all,
talking
but
unconventional places.
But this
where
is where people relax, complain, or are they going to use this as a place to become more creative and more exciting?
Mm. You're listening to Ask. I'm Michelle Martin. My guest this evening is Andrew Grant, author of Who Killed Creativity. We'll come back with more of your questions, hopefully, at 669-11938 in just a while.
This is Ask with your host, Michelle Martin, on 938 Live.
You're listening to Ask. I'm Michelle Martin. Thank you so much for calling through 669-11938 if you have a question on creativity and how we can get it back. 7 essential strategies to make yourself, your team, and your organization more innovative. What are some of the key essential strategies, in your opinion, for Asia, for Singapore in particular?
Well, I think one of the strategies is that we need to look at how we can get it back. I talked about starting with asking questions to get that mind cultivated, to get that mind thinking about what needs to be done. We need to look at unleashing our imagination, so moving away from that very structured part of our environment and maybe finding places to play. For me, it's my sport. For someone else, it might be meditation. It doesn't really matter, but just giving the brain the chance to process non-conscious thoughts. We need to access the left and right side of the brain. The more kinesthetic, creative side. Our brain is like a muscle.
Mm.
You know, I've got overdeveloped muscles on my left hand from tennis. You know, if we're using our left side of the brain, which is the more analytical side, and we're trying to solve every problem from that, including school, then that's the side that will naturally try to solve problems. We need to start thinking about, I even encourage people to clean their teeth with a different hand. Mm. Just so there's something you can do tonight.
Interrupt the patterns of the way you...
If you're driving home tonight, change your feet over on the accelerator the brake, but you know, we don't want to change the traffic anymore, do we?
So what are some other brain exercises that you do?
Well, I think I now deliberately, now that after having that surfing accident and realizing just how powerful the brain is, I'm not going to let it just freewheel and it dictate to me. I used the example this morning that you know, many of those killers we can see coming a mile off, but the classic one is stress.
Mm.
You know, you ask anyone in the corporate world how they are, they say they're stressed as if it's a cool thing to say. I mean, they don't say, I'm good. If you said to someone, I'm good, they'd look at you strange. What, you don't work hard enough? So stress is one of those killers that we like to actually hang out with. I think if we want to be strategic and be more creative, we need to identify, look, you know, it's time to put stress to bed. And not with us. We tend to, as I said, we stress is so funny, we bring her home, or him, home. We have dinner with him. We say, come to bed. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, stress knocks on our brain and says, hey, wake up, I've got something for you. Again, we're not letting the brain get into that creative mode. So we just have to watch these things carefully and not allow them just to naturally happen. We need to take control of our thoughts.
Mm.
We need to take control of our brain. And we need to take control of the environment we're in.
You know, there's this big debate now on preschool and whether we can shake up the sector. And we've heard examples of parents sending their children to two kindergartens because everybody wants to give their child, you know, as much of a head start as they can as early as possible. Do you have some advice for parents who think, you know, how can I up the creativity of my child?
Well, okay, so let's be clear. If we want to up the academic side of the child, then we send them to two kindergartens. We pick them up at 5 o'clock. We take them to maths classes followed by science classes. If that's the path that we want to go down, they'll become geniuses in maths or science. Possibly we'll be competing against computers in the future. If we think in what are the skills that, and this is back to what worked in the 90s may not necessarily work now. What are the skills that are going to be needed in the future? Is it going to be more computing, maths, mathematical power? Maybe. But if we want our children to be creative, and that's what I'm talking about today. So I'm not saying it's wrong to do that, but if we want our children to be creative, there is solid research that they need to spend more time in free play. Just playing unstructured. And this danger of over-educating or over-teaching, which, as I said, hit the front page of the Straits Times yesterday, is a raging debate. I think it needs to be debated. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm not saying there's a clear-cut black and white. I think we need more discussion on the topic. We need to ask ourselves, do we want to breed more academic geniuses, which Asia is very good at doing, or do we want to breed more creativity people? What's needed in the future? Do we need more creative people or do we need more academic geniuses? And then from that decision, then we may want to start thinking about the education we give our children.
Now, you personify creativity in this book as a she who is a murder victim. But I have to say...
No, she or he.
I read a she part. But the point I'm trying to make is actually I think you personify the joy of reading this book. Absolute pleasure talking to you. It's been a brilliant conversation. Thank you so much for the insights and for being here, Andrew Grant.
Thank you very much.